Well, I had quite an interesting day yesterday. The Lubbock Interfaith Alliance put on yesterday a day-long first annual Lubbock Interfaith Dialogue Conference. And I was interested in that just on the face of it. I got a lot more interested in it when a month or so ago they asked me to participate. So I went. And the keynote speakers are three guys who call themselves the Interfaith Amigos. Rabbi Ted, Pastor Don, Imam Jamal, all originally from the Seattle area, and they had noddingly been acquainted for some time, but after 9/11, they found themselves getting together and saying, you know what, we have to change the content of this dialogue. And they became the Interfaith Amigos and have taken their show on the road. Yesterday it stopped in Lubbock. They have a website. They've written a couple of books. I will link to our website, their website, and there might well be a quiz next week. Well, my part of the conference was to be on one of the breakout panels that that presented in the afternoon. I was on a panel with a Jewish psychologist from Lubbock and a Muslim scientist from the Health Sciences Center, and we were all charged with presenting a little bit of what we had on religious extremism. And so I did a thing on Christian extremism. And since it's all I got, I thought I'd share that with you today. But it is, in fact, rooted at the end in a story from the New Testament. And you got a preview of that when Cohen and I were talking a little while ago. From John's Gospel, chapter 21. When they got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire there with fish lying on it and bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish you've caught." So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore full of large fish, 153 of them, and although there were so many, the net had not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." Now none of the disciples dared to ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and so with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus was revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. When Jesus had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Feed my lambs." A second time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to them, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said, "Tend my sheep." He said to him a third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep." Told you it was a presentation. We have been taught that history is written by the winners. And actually, before it's history, events are policy, and policy is implemented by the winners. Christians have won in the United States. 80% of all Americans claim to be Christian. It's different than worldwide. Roughly 30% of the world's population are Christian, similar and nearly equal to that of Islam. Third on the list, the third most commonly claimed religion on earth is no religion, which is kind of interesting. We are Christians and arguably the winners in, to whatever extent, religion influences policy, economics, social justice. So I would say, to whom much is given, much would be required. It's a stewardship issue, it seems to me, since we're on the winning team. It's interesting to me that Christianity was born of religious extremism. This new way of being Jewish was a challenge to the old way of being Jewish, which was pretty extreme in its way of implementing, legislating, and punishing adherence or breaking of Jewish law. The old way of being Jewish, the threat to which Jesus came, was organized, bureaucratized, hierarchical, and controlling. Now, when it became clear to the early Christians that the second coming would be delayed, in fact, delayed by now 20 centuries, those early Christians became Christianity, which in very short order became organized, bureaucratized, hierarchical, and controlling. Sound familiar? Which led to, among other things, a dark side, extremism. We don't talk much about the Crusades, but they are part of our Christian history. We don't talk much about the Peasants' Revolt that Martin Luther and other reformers sought to put down, a quest for justice that the church regarded as ungodly. We do talk a little bit about Galileo and Copernicus and the debate over what shape was the earth, and where does the sun go, and how does all that work? And Galileo was excommunicated in a plea bargain away from execution, for in a sense, getting it right. Interesting to me is that the content and logic of that debate over the nature of the earth and God's creation is exactly the same as what is going on right now. And there were two articles in yesterday's paper concerning debate, revising, and revamping, and allocating authority to those who dream up and legislate high school biology curricula. Same debate, same logic, same tension between church and science, faith and science. The quest for civil rights, the quest for women's rights, the definition of pro-life, and the whole debate over gay rights and same-sex marriage are examples of a debate that at least on one side is arguably Christian extremism. A colleague of mine, Luis Ramirez, and I wrote an article that was published in 2010, and we got way less blowback on this than I was anticipating, where we were able to demonstrate statistically that people who are students, and students at UTEP and El Paso, who held deeply fundamentalist Christian beliefs, were a little bit more likely, measurably more likely, to hit or hurt their partners. Some people said, well, why'd you even ask that question? Well, we know that Christian fundamentalists are at least more likely to hit their kids. So we thought, I wonder if it extends to partners, and it turns out it does. Which goes to one of the major critiques of Christianity that comes out of actually my discipline. One of the dead white guys in sociology is named Karl Marx. Cue the Darth Vader music. I tell my students when I introduce, well, we call him affectionately Uncle Charlie, come on. When I introduce Marxist thought, I say, this is the part of sociology your ministers warned you about. Marx was not fond of religion, and here's why. His writing is lengthy and impenetrable, but it boils down to an understanding of, at least the way I can describe it, you know the story in the New Testament of the rich man and Lazarus. We have this archetypal wealthy landowner, and we have this poor leper, sad, sorry guy at his gate. And they don't have much to do with each other. Lazarus, at best, gets the crumbs that fall from the table. And then in the story Jesus tells, after they both die, they switch places. And in the afterlife, the poor guy, the sad, sorry guy, winds up in the arms of Father Abraham. Marx argued this. He said that if that's what Christians believe, if they believe that the sadder and sorrier their life is on earth, the better the odds of going to heaven when they die, all that does is it gives license to powerful people to abuse Christians because they'll take it. They'll even embrace it. And that's why Marx called Christianity the opiate of the masses, because you can control people whose focus is on the afterlife. Religious extremism, Christian extremism specifically, starts with an assumption that when it becomes institutionalized, it becomes an assertion, and when it goes amok, it becomes a compulsion. And the assumption, the assertion, the compulsion is this: God likes me better than you. That is the root of religious extremism, which is a license to control people. If I can convince you with authority that God likes me better than you, you have to start being more like me. which is a license to oppress. It's kind of an interesting juxtaposition and convergence of Marxist atheism and Christian fundamentalism. I think that's intriguing. Actually, I think it's kind of funny. It's amazing to me how anything in Christianity can become contentious. We believe, all Christians believe, that the initiation right into the church is the sacrament of holy baptism. We baptize, identify, and name, and draw people in. We all agree on that, until we start fighting about how much water to use. We all agree that the sacrament of belonging is Holy Communion, that we feed each other, both metaphorically and literally, with the body and blood of Christ, until we argue and don't associate with those who do or do not ferment the grapes. That's just the start. You know, this whole notion of God likes me better than you, which I believe leads to extremism, takes hold more insidiously when we truly come to believe that not only does God like me better than you, but I'm going to go to heaven and you're not. Because I did this and you didn't. I believe that and you don't. I've expressed myself in this way and you haven't yet. And until you do, watch the hell out. Right? I think there's one good thing about John Calvin's doctrine of predestination, which is really scary. It basically argues that God has known since creation who wouldn't get into heaven. And if you're on that list, good for you. If you're not, there's nothing you can do about it. Now, that has been wildly misinterpreted and misconstrued. We usually talk about it only in caricature. And I don't have a way to resolve the mystery except to suggest that it gives us one interesting insight. The doctrine of predestination says, unequivocally, I think, that heaven is not your deal. Heaven is not your deal. Jesus didn't do enough on the cross. You have to do something else. It's not your deal. Which, in a way, is sort of frightening because we want to know what our deal is so we can control it. But Jesus is not big on control, apparently. If heaven is not your deal, all the energy that goes into the rhetoric about heaven and hell can be redirected, it seems to me. Who first? Who fastest? Who gets to sit where? Not your deal. Well, what is your deal? Maybe you were here. I don't remember how long ago it's been, but I did preach a sermon one time called Lunch with Jesus. And in it, I made the argument that if you were to have the opportunity to have lunch with Jesus, maybe a half hour, and a la the story of Aladdin and the lamp, he was to grant you and participate with you in solving one social problem, one social problem, what would it be? And I tell that story to my students when I do a riff on same-sex marriage, in which I essentially say, you know what, this is not a big deal. Get over it, you know. And would you put that at the head of the list of things to solve? And anything attendant to the whole issue of same-sex marriage and gay rights, is that the most important thing you can think of? And even then they go, well, probably not. Well, it's a way of illustrating, you know, what would you prioritize if you could have that happen? Well, I don't know what lunch with Jesus would go like, and it probably wouldn't go like that. But we do know how breakfast with Jesus would go. It's right there in the New Testament at the very end of his life. On the basis of his having died and rose for the sins of the world, he comes to Simon Peter and says, "Feed my lambs." Now, I think you could put the Christian gospel next to the Torah, next to the Quran, next to any other sacred text, toss in collections of Greek and Roman mythology, books of moral philosophy, ethics, and in all of those you would find at least one common thread that I think could be described metaphorically as feed my lambs. All of us could agree, it would seem to me, on a ministry agenda that would seek to make all the lambs safe, all the lambs fed, all the lambs well. We could all agree that that's worthwhile and noble work, and we could work together to make it happen. There may come a day when the afterlife discussion becomes relevant, and it would be interesting, if not useful, to figure out who first and how fast and where they get to sit. But I think if and only if and not until all the lambs are fed, all the lambs are safe, and all the lambs are well. Amen.